is the last formal talk of the retreat. So quickly it goes, and especially if one learns how to let go, be kind, live in the present moment, enjoy the moment. You do get into a timelessness, and even the days don't seem to have any meaning, let alone the hours and the minutes and seconds. So the last talk of the retreat, I usually try and bring things together to see what you've actually learned on this retreat and just how it affects your life afterwards when you leave here. One thing you'll notice, it's a strange thing, but it does happen, that you don't realise how much you've slowed down and how much you've become calm. It's only later on this afternoon, when you get in the vehicle and start driving home or being driven home, do you realise just how harsh it is outside there in that world. How fast people go, and how sometimes insensitive they are to the things of the world, including you. And just how, you know, in our busyness to try and get somewhere, we just trample over so many moments, never really caring for it. This is quite a shock when you first leave here. I remember many times, especially my first time I did a retreat, just going afterwards, at the end of the retreat, back to the where I was living. It seemed to be just you were moving into another world. You never realised that you'd actually come from that world before. And over a period of 9 days, a week or 2 weeks, however long it is, you do actually change. But because everybody changes at the same rate, we sometimes don't notice just how we're all slowing down. It's like the traffic slowing down when there's many, many lanes. And you judge your speed by the cars next to you. We judge our speed by the vehicles around us. We don't realise just how much we've cooled off. And that's an interesting thing to notice, because that will give you a comparison for which to understand just the effect of this meditation. Maybe just because of one's habits, one is now looking with expectation of getting home later on and doing all those things which you've left there, finishing off your business or eating in the evening or watching a movie or whatever it is you're planning to do. And you can also see that just how much we live our life always in expectation of the next thing, never or rarely being here, and always just rushing off for something else. And I said this morning that the only thing we're rushing towards is our coffin. That's what I said this morning. So why are you actually rushing so fast? It's your funeral, so you're trying to get life out of the way for it, to get it over, and then it's just to get in your coffin, that's all. So when we actually look at it that way, we actually make sure that we value these moments we have. And it's part of the training you learn here, is actually to make sure that every moment, even the last hour, the last half hour, the last minute, the last second, are enjoyed. And to get all the juice out of every moment, because this life is very precious. A lot of the time, the reason why we do rush off in our life is because we don't know how to be present. And sometimes we're afraid of being present. Sometimes it's just we've been trained throughout our whole life to actually always to be rushing around. And this retreat, you've gone in a different direction. And it's been hard sometimes, in the sense it's going against that grain. I say it's easy because the more you do it, the more ease you feel. So it may be sort of uncomfortable or unusual, but after a while you get familiar with this path, and it becomes such a wonderful way to spend 9 days. You could have spent those 9 days going to some club med somewhere, but you'll find that if you went to some holiday resort, you'll never be as peaceful as you get during a retreat. As far as your health is concerned, you never get as healthy as when you allow the body and the mind to really relax. So never, instead of actually giving you things to make you relax, you've always like allowed just time, space, freedom, and encouragement for you to relax. At the very least, you know, you've managed to catch up on your sleep. So you go back, you're not so tight and tense. So you look at actually, you know, what you've actually learned here, and the main thing which you've learned, and one of the main purposes of a retreat like this, you've learned this thing called letting go. Now, of course, during a retreat, sometimes rebel a little bit about letting go, because they say, well, you know, when you're out in the world, you have to do things. Yes, you do have to do things. And later on this afternoon, this evening, tomorrow or something, you'll be back there having to manage your life, to do your duties to your family, to your business, profession, whatever. But at least you've remembered, or you should recall, you've learned another way of action or inaction, which you can include in your ordinary life. So that during the busyness of your life, you always can learn to take those moments out, those times of peacefulness when you can truly just let go. You've learned that activity, or that inactivity if you like, that skill to be able to put down the burdens of the mind, to put down the burdens of the body, to put down the burdens of the past, and just really learn how to relax. The more you do this, the more skillful you become, and it becomes one of these life skills which you'll find invaluable. And the reason is because there are many times in your life out there in the world, and you know, I am sometimes a very busy mind as well, so I know what it's like. I'm a CEO. And it sometimes does get very busy. But now you have another tool, another skill which you can use. You've all heard me say before the reason why we have stress when you do the sin of holding up a cup. It's not the weight of the cup, it's not the amount of duties you have to perform in this world. It's not all the worries bearing down upon you, because that's what people complain about. Oh, I have to do this. Oh, I have to do that. Oh, I've got so many problems and so many difficulties, so many things to do. That is not the problem. The problem is we don't know how, from time to time, to put down our burden and really rest. To put the cup down. So afterwards you lift it up and it feels lighter. It's easier to carry. So it's not the amount of things you have to do in the world. Please remember that. Don't go complaining, thinking, justifying your stress and your stress levels and your irritation, your anger, because of all the things you have to do. You can always find time, if you really want to put down that burden and just rest for a few minutes. And you know that it's an investment of time. If it's 5 minutes or 10 minutes of meditation, I mean real letting go. I'm talking not about sort of striving meditation, struggling meditation, because that will just make you more tense than when you started. The sort of meditation, the sort of attitude you'll be learning here. You know, forgiveness, letting go, door of my heart's open to this moment, not controlling, just allowing things to be, contentment, freedom, all those words all pointing to the same thing. That's what you do when you sit down and rest. You don't necessarily watch the breath, whatever object it is, it's how you're watching it, that's how you meditate. To make sure you watch those objects with peace. You make peace in every moment, no matter what you experience. Even if you're tired, you make peace with being tired. You don't try and get rid of that tiredness. You're in the moment, being at peace with the moment, not trying to get rid of this moment to get another moment, which you somehow feel is better. When you do that, you can rest. And 5 or 10 minutes of rest is an investment. I say it's an investment because it means that after that rest, you find you're much more efficient, your mind is clearer, if you have to make decisions, there's more chance those decisions are right, because you're not making decisions with a tired mind, which is overburdened, which just makes decisions out of fear or not having all the right information at your fingertips. You don't get so angry, so you don't have all these personal problems you have to fix up afterwards, which takes a lot of our time. You're healthier, you're more at peace, you're happier. In every which way, that 5 or 10 minutes of letting go can really help. And now you know how to let go. Or at least you get some tricks or some skills in learning how to rest and relax. And so this is why, in this retreat, what you learned here, you will find, will affect your daily life. You will be a more peaceful person, and you will have the ability just to have quiet time. Like I mentioned, I'm not sure if it's in interviews or during the talks, there's one of the teachers who used to teach in Rolleystone Primary School. Saw her just the other day, that she always used to teach meditation to the Year Sixes. That was her class. Took year after year after year after year. She taught meditation by calling it quiet time, just for 5 minutes in the beginning of the school year, building it up to about 15 to 20 minutes by the end of the school year. And she found that that quiet time, which is so important in many, many ways. So I visited that school a couple of times and I talked to the headmaster, who was a Christian, and he said, "I'm not a Buddhist, but I've seen that meditation and that class really work." He said that that particular class always does very well. Their learning school skills really improve. Because when you rest, have a bit of quiet time, it actually enhances your mindfulness. This ability to absorb the information of the world because you're still. And of course, that's at the heart of education. You can present the facts. You can present the methods of doing things, but how many people can actually really soak the information in? And again, it's only when you're peaceful and calm. You like having a sponge which is all dry and it soaks up all the water. But if your sponge is already very damp or even soggy wet, it won't soak up any more water. You can understand that simile. When we've got so many burdens, we're thinking about so much, we're so full, we can't soak up anything. We're like a sponge which is so soggy it can't actually absorb anything more. But if you are nice and dry, you're empty, you're free. It's amazing what you can learn, what you can absorb, and so easily as well. I remember just, sometimes that when you were listening to a talk, sometimes you were so still. You didn't need to try and remember it, but you would remember it, simply because you were still. One of the great ways of having a good memory is just to stop and listen, and open the mind, and it imprints itself on you very easily. If you try to remember and control it, it's very hard to remember. This is that memory inside us, this way of learning. And so the headmaster found out that these kids really learned, but there was other things than that. He found that whenever there was any problems in the classroom, any sort of altercations, one of the children in the class would raise their hand and say, "Miss, can we have quiet time now?" So everyone had to stop, and everyone just sat still for 5 or 10 minutes. And all the aggression, all the irritation just vanished, as it does when you are still. If you get anger or irritation with your husband, with your wife, with your kids, with life, don't go arguing with them. Go and sit still for a little while and see what happens. After you sat still, there's no need to argue anymore. In the first years of my monastery, or the monastery in Thailand where I grew up, we used to, as I mentioned already, used to stay up all night once a week meditating without sleeping, going without sleep. And I always would notice any arguments in that monastery always happened the morning after staying up all night. And it didn't take Einstein to realise what was going on. It happened to me as well. Sometimes, you know, you see these scallywag monks sneaking off. They thought no one was looking, but I saw them sneak off to take a little bit of a nap. They're not supposed to do that. I saw them sneaking around having a cup of tea or a cup of coffee they weren't supposed to have. I saw them doing all those things they weren't supposed to do. And so I thought that, you know, that I should tell them off. That's my duty. Especially when you start to, you know, become an arrogant monk. It becomes your duty to tell off all the others. Well, I thought, if I don't tell them, you know, who will tell them? They need to know. That's what you think. And you're the one who's got to tell them. So, I remember one day writing a list. There's one particular monk who was really misbehaving. Writing a list of all the things, you know, that I saw that night they'd done wrong, so I could tell them off. And normally, you know, you'd sort of go up to them straight away and tell them off. But this day, I decided, I'm going to keep that piece of paper. I'm going to tell them off in the afternoon when I've had a good sleep. Have a rest first of all, then try to tell them off. So I kept the piece of paper, they weren't going to get away with this. So I put the piece of paper down, had a nice nap. When I got up afterwards, I saw that piece of paper and it was just such petty things. When I had rested and felt good, then I thought, why on earth am I going to sort of tell a good monk off for these, you know, silly little things? And I realised, in those experiences like that, a lot of times we argue and we criticise other people, not because of what they're doing, it's because we feel tired. Because we haven't rested. Because we, you know, feel a bit sort of a lack of ease, a lack of health, a lack of joy inside. That's actually a lot of times why people get grumpy. They're just tired or they're sick, that's all. So having noticed that, I realised that, okay, before I tell anybody else off, I'll have a good rest, first of all. Have a good meditation, so I feel at peace. And that stops a lot of criticism, and a lot of bad feeling, and a lot of these altercations which happen in any community. whether it's a monastery, whether it's your office, or whether it's your family. So when we start to meditate, instead of, you know, just shooting our mouth off, then you find that a lot of arguments disappear. And with those, a lot of arguments disappear, a lot of frustration, a lot of wasting of time. How much time is wasted in an office? Well, fortunately, in a monastery, it's not wasted very much. We don't have many altercations in a monastery. But how much time is wasted in your life? Because, you know, you said something wrong, or someone said something wrong to you, you think about that, you have to deal with it, there's problems, there's difficulties, especially if it ends in a divorce. But that takes a lot of time and money. So instead of wasting all that time, wasting all that money, and wasting all of that happiness, it's an investment. Give 5 or 10 minutes of meditation, and you save hours. Learn how to make your mind peaceful and calm, and you save thousands of dollars on the divorce settlement. Because you don't have it in the first place. And you save days and days and days and sort of heartache because not getting all these terrible illnesses. You save so much. So it is like an investment. So I'm mentioning that because sometimes people say, I've got no time to meditate when I leave here. I am so busy. I've got so many things to do. I'm a busy person. I'm an important man or woman. I've got things to do. You can't just sit down and do nothing. If you are busy, if you have got lots of things to do, then it is incredibly important. More important than if you have plenty of time. It's more important to meditate. The reason is because you haven't got any time to waste. If you've got lots of time on your hands, it's okay. I mean, you don't have to meditate because, you know, you've got plenty of time to fix up all the problems you cause. But if you're a very busy person, you haven't got time to waste. You've got to be efficient. You can't afford to make problems. You've got to be on the ball, and smart, sensitive, especially if you're in business. It's a very, very cutthroat market these days. In the religious business. So I've got to be sharp to keep my market share. Whatever it is you're doing in life, if you're not sharp, if you're not on the ball, again, you lose your customers and you don't survive in this world. So it's for your business, it's for your life, it's for your happiness, for everything. And it all comes down to finding that time. When you realize how important it is, you can easily find the time. Many people who say they haven't got the time to meditate, if there's a favourite movie on, you find the time. There's no problem whatsoever. Many men, when there's a World Cup soccer on or Olympic Games, they can stay up 1, 2, 3 o'clock at night. No trouble at all. They can always find the time. But the point is, if it's really important for you, you will find the time. And that's why it's very important. When you realize what this meditation does, and you realize what happens when you don't meditate, and just how much time you waste, and how much trouble there is in your life, and also in yourself, you realize this is vital. Meditating is the same as eating. That's why when people say, how long should I meditate every day when I leave here? I say, how long time do you spend eating? And make it the same amount of time you spend eating, the same amount of time you spend meditating. Minimum. Because meditation is like food for the heart. You know, the food, the rice, bread, potatoes, curries, whatever, that's food for the body. But if you have food for the body, you may have a healthy body and be very strong, but still be psychotic, still be depressed, still be really all over the place with your relationship to yourself and relationship to others. But if you know how to feed yourself good food for the heart as well, a little bit of meditation, quietness, silence, you have a healthy heart, a healthy mind. And a healthy heart and a healthy mind, you know that because that means you're happy. That's a sign of a healthy heart and a healthy mind. You're easy to get along with and you get along easy with others because you're easy to get along with yourself. You're learning those skills of letting go. And it also means that when you learn those skills of letting go, you become a much softer heart. When you feed it very well, you become far more soft, far more malleable. So when things go wrong in your life, you can accept that rather than just breaking. You have the simile between the tree and the reed or the piece of bamboo. When the wind blows, the storms blow, it's the big stout trees, the strong guys and the firm women. It's the strong ones, the big ones, they're the ones which fall over. The slender bamboo or the reeds, they bend. They know how to let go, to go with the flow. They bend so they never break. So what we do, when the mind is going crazy, instead of fighting it, it's going to break us. We actually bend with loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to you, wind, come in. There's one of the stories in the Buddhist Suttas, which is a well-known story, but it has, like many of those stories, a far deeper meaning. And it's the story of Nalagiri, the elephant. Towards the end of the Buddha's life, now out of jealousy, the king and the Buddha's cousin Devadatta were trying to kill the Buddha. And so one of their plans was, one morning when the Buddha was going on alms round, was to release this very huge elephant, having made it drunk, first of all. So it was like a raging, mad, crazy elephant. Now elephants are so huge, and it's when they get crazy, they're so dangerous. They very easily kill people. I know there's a story of this monk who got killed in Thailand a few years ago. He went into the jungles with his attendant, just the monk and his attendant, and he saw this wild elephant. Usually elephants are quiet, you know, even in the wild. They'll leave you alone if you leave them alone. But the monk decided to take a photograph of the elephant. And that's actually how they knew how the two of them died. Because they found the two of them crushed, and they found this camera, and they developed the film. And they found the first photograph of the elephant. The elephant was quite peaceful. The second photograph, it was looking at them. Third photograph, you could see the rage in the elephant's eyes. And there was not a fourth photograph. The camera had a flash. And the elephant, a flash was like the flash of a gun. And the elephant got afraid. And sort of, obviously crushed the monk and his attendant. It was a silly thing to do. So, so this elephant, Nalagiri, was crazy and was running towards the Buddha. Now how? The Buddha's got psychic powers. The Buddha's incredibly strong. So if you had all those psychic powers, like a eight dan black belt, what would you do with the elephant? Just grab it by the trunk, swirl it 2-3 times around your head, and karate chop it, sort of behind the ears. What would you do? Now that's a lot of times what you do. When you have a Nalagiri mind, this raging, crazy mind, it might be intoxicated with anger, with lust, or whatever. With a raging mind, you've all experienced that raging mind, it will not sort of be controlled, and it's bearing down upon you like some huge elephant crashing down upon you. If you try and fight that, even if you've got all the psychic powers of the Buddha, it will beat you. That's not the way that the Buddha conquered Nalagiri. This huge elephant, about 20 times the size of the Buddha, crazy with madness because of being drunk and being goaded. So what the Buddha did was just gave it loving kindness. Suffused it with metta. Nalagiri, the door of my heart's open to you. You can crush me if you want to. You can take me up with your trunk. And you can swirl me around. Even though I've got more power than you, I will not use it. Nalagiri, do with me what you wish. The door of my heart is open to you. Remember, it's unconditioned loving kindness. Not expecting anything. Being at peace, being content with whatever happens. Now that's actually the mind of the Buddha in front of this mad elephant. What had happened to that mad elephant? The mad elephant just couldn't stand such compassion and kindness. And the craziness, even the drunkenness, the madness, abated. And Nalagiri just bowed its head gently in front of the Buddha to pat it on its trunk. There, Nalagiri. And this was actually the story which everybody saw, a very famous story in the time of the Buddha. Continuing on that metaphor, if you say to your crazy, raging mind, the Nalagiri mind, the mad elephant mind, which is much bigger than you, much stronger than you. Mad, crazy mind, the door of my heart's open to you. You can do with me whatever you want, but I will be at peace with you. Unconditional acceptance. And then you'll find, just like that story, the great psychic power of the Buddha was not a psychic power of will, but a psychic power of understanding. The psychic power of letting go. And that mind, in a few seconds, will be bowing down in front of you, allowing you to stroke it gently. There, there. We all get sort of crazy sometimes. It's all right. That's how we deal with the Nalagiri mind. And I'm sure that you all have Nalagiri mind. Maybe you had it during this retreat. You're always going crazy. And hopefully you found out that if you fight that crazy mind, how many times have you done that in your life? Really tried to subdue the crazy mind. And what's happened? A lot of times it made you more crazy. So you've learned this other skill, which is powerful. And you actually can put that into practice in your daily life. And my goodness, it works. When there's nothing to do, you let go. Must have been about the fifth year or something when I was a monk in Thailand, when Ajahn Chacko was the Abbot of Wat Nanachan, I was his second monk. One day, one of the farmers, it was the son of one of the chief supporters of our monastery, Por Am's son, he was taking his water buffalo out to graze one morning, as you know, you do in the dry season. And it's not an easy task, you know, the water buffaloes know what to do. You just take them out to graze, leave them alone, put a stake in the ground, tie them up, and let the water buffalo just graze peacefully. They're very peaceful beings, usually. But every now and again, they sometimes get spooked, and they get sort of excited. And he was just taking this water buffalo, just on the road, which actually encircles the monastery. And his water buffalo spooked. And he must have seen another water buffalo somewhere, or something made it afraid. And it tried to run off. And this stupid man, this stupid farmer, tried to stop the water buffalo. Now you see, maybe in the movies, or you may have actually, in the pictures, or you may have actually been to that part of Asia and seen how big and strong those water buffaloes are. They're much stronger than a human being. If the human beings were strong, they'd get the human beings to plow the fields. The water buffalo does that job. And he tried to stop the water buffalo. And because of that, so the string which he was holding the water buffalo by, very quickly in a second, just twirled around his finger and it pulled the top of his finger off. And that's why he actually came to the monastery with half a finger and blood all over it. So he quickly took him to the hospital and sort of got him bandaged up. It wasn't life threatening, he just, you know, to find it difficult now to pick his nose. That's a big one. But it was a great little story which we've all used from time to time, actually just show just what happens when we don't know how to let go at the right time. Because when we don't know how to let go, there's something much stronger than us, and we try to stop it, and it just pulls our finger off, or something even worse. We get hurt, and we get wounded, and we get lots of suffering. And everybody knows that those water buffaloes, just let them go, they won't go very far. At the very most, half a kilometre or a kilometre up the road, and then they'll stop. Because they know who looks after them, they know who cares for them, they're actually part of the family in Thailand. They'll always sort of come back, because they don't know where to go otherwise. They've got no place to sleep, no place to actually to people to look after them. So they run off, and they only go a little way. And the right farm's in the right mind, they let go, and the thing runs off, and then the farmer walks after them. And when it's run off, calm down, just pulls it back, and it'll follow without any problem at all. And that's actually how a lot of times we deal with the unstoppable forces in life. Even if it might be your children. You try and stop them, they'll pull your finger off. Because they are much bigger and more determined than you are, so you let them go, and they can't go that far. And they go a little way further, then you can actually pull them back. That is how we deal with children. It may be your husband. Okay, there you go. And when he's calmed down, then you can pull him back. Otherwise, it pulls off a lot of the troubles in life. Now the problem is, we all know that makes sense. But a lot of times we just forget, we don't know how to do it. It might be, say, someone dies in your family. Like a big attachment has run off. What can you do with that? If you try and hold it, then it just pulls you off. It just pulls off your happiness. You get wounded. That's why we have this saying, when there's nothing to do, do nothing, yeah. And people understand that, it makes a lot of sense, when there's nothing to do, do nothing. But how do I do nothing? In this retreat, what was there to do? Nothing to do all 9 days. What did you do? I did something. I was meditating. So when people, when you go home and they ask you, what do you do all this? So you say nothing. And they won't understand you. But if you're a good monk, a good nun, they'd understand you. That's a good meditator. Spent the whole 9 days doing nothing. Not trying to achieve something, not trying to get somewhere, not trying to be a better person. Ego, self, conceit. I am much better than those lazy people who never meditated this week. I am much better. I'm a Buddhist, much better than those Christians. See, it's conceit again, isn't it? So often we can get into those conceit things. So I am much better than those other people or whatever it is. And don't get into conceit. Then you know why we do nothing. When we do nothing, all that I business disappears. We're just being, that's all. Actually, we're just being less and less, softer and softer, disappearing from the busyness of the world by resting, by doing nothing. So we're learning how to do nothing, and how hard it is to do nothing. Because we always think, I should be getting something out of this meditation. What have you got out of this meditation retreat? If someone says, I've got nothing at all out of this meditation retreat, I go, sadhu, 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 a success at last. And other people say, did you get jhana? Which jhana did you get? First, second, third, fourth? Did you get enlightenment? Which stage of enlightenment? Ah, oh, that's nothing. Fellow sitting next to you, oh, you've got much more than that. Now, this is not the way to be a fit. This is letting go of all of that. And a strange thing happened. Now, that's how you get jhana. That's how you get sort of enlightenment. Not by the attainments, not by spiritual materialism, but by letting go. And that's how you get peace in the world. Success in the world is one thing, success in life is another. People may be millionaires, big houses, they seem to have achieved all their goals, superstars, but they have to have therapists, they want all sorts of medication, they have to go into rehab. I just noticed when reading the papers, when New Zealand film stars become famous, they move to Australia. When Australians become famous, they move to England. When English film stars become famous, they move to the United States. When United States film stars become famous, they go to rehab. What happens? So all those famous people always on the move. And just the really happy people, the real famous people, those people are still unhappy wherever they are. They don't have to go anywhere. You want to go somewhere? Do you want to go home? Why is it that people always want to go somewhere thinking that's where we get happiness? And that's doing again. Now here you've learned how to be at peace. And when you learn how to be at peace, you have a huge skill which will help you throughout the whole of your life. Come a time when you're sick, in hospital. You can't do anything then. You might get worried about your sickness and try and get well. The more you try and get well, the worse it gets, too much stress. So here, you know, when there's nothing to do, we do nothing. If you're sick, enjoy being sick. Put happiness into the sickness. You've got mindfulness, just being in the present moment, contentment, then happiness comes up. One of my key experiences, my young years as a monk, I developed typhus fever, as every monk in those early years developed in Wat Nanachat Monastery in northeast Thailand. There were these little mites which gave you scrub typhus. But all the locals were immune because they'd grown up there, born there, and their body had a natural immunity to it. So it's only like the rest of us when we first moved to this monastery, especially when you go sleeping on the ground, you know, just to live simply, you started getting this fever. And first of all, people thought it was typhoid because of the dirty food. But eventually, the one doctor found out, and he was a very smart man, he said, this has all the symptoms of scrub typhus. Went to the local health authority and said, look, there's no scrub typhus in this area. He said, yes, there is. They said, no, there isn't. And so he used his influence, contacted some people in Bangkok. They came up and did a test, and yeah, there was those little mites on the ground. I mean, it's only because the locals were immune, the Westerners weren't. But when I got scrub typhus, you know, we didn't know really what it was, and so it was just a fever, so you went into hospital. And I remember that hospital very well, because this was a third world country in that time, 1974, 5 or 6 or something. Third world country, and this was in Ubon, which was, that was the backwater of the third world country. Everyone else, so that's where all the Hicks lived, that was backwards area. And that had been Ubon Hospital. And that hospital, of all the wards, it was the monks' ward, like, you know, the free ward. And of all those wards, that was probably the least well looked after. So in the least well looked after ward of a at least province of a third world country. So it was, you know, pretty backwards. And I always remember this nurse who would come in twice a day, because, you know, you had something wrong with you. They didn't know what, so they shoved antibiotics into you, injected into your bottom. But the needles they used to use in those days are not like the needles they use now. There were always those reusable ones they tried to sterilize, you know, the past. And the thing was that by the time Leslie came to a third world country, they weren't exactly the sharpest or the best. And all the best ones, I always thought they'd probably use them in Bangkok first of all, before they shipped them off to the provinces, because they're poor hospitals. And they'd use them in the provinces, you know, for the ordinary wards, and then the last use would be for the monks, because the monks were supposed to be tough. So those leaders, they were incredibly blunt. And the nurse was actually built like a water buffalo. Because you had to be, to stab it in your buttocks. Yeah, try to say this, baby. After a while, you know, you're supposed to be like, you know, I'm a forest monk, I'm tough, but after a while you started to hate that person. You know, and that's what it was like. And you had a fever as well, and you felt terrible with fever. And you had scrub typhus or any of those huge fevers, you got absolutely no energy. To go to the toilet, no one would help, there's no bedpans. I remember actually going to the toilet. It was like an expedition, like climbing Mount Everest. You know, in those old wards, you had beds next to each other. So you get up, and then you take another 5-10 minutes to get some energy after all the energy of getting up. And you'd lurch to the next bed. You'd reach out to the railing to grab on, rest a little bit, and then reach out to the next one. And after about half an hour, maybe it took that long, I'm not joking, you got into that toilet, and you made sure you finished all your business. Because you didn't want to go there again the next, you know, 6 or 7 hours. That's how sort of weak you felt. And no one else could help you. There was no night nurse in those hospitals. You were just left to yourself, own resources. So, imagine just, you know, how sort of, you know, upset you felt. And you felt really a long way from home, just so weak and just in pain, feel really awful. I remember one day just feeling just so awful, so, you know, terrible, depressed. And I thought, okay, let's meditate. Let go. Again, do another letting go meditation. And there, with all that fever and that pain, you can just really let go. Let go of the pain, let go of worry, let go of everything. And you went into a nice, really lovely meditation. Really into deep bliss. And at the time, I couldn't understand this. No, how can you do this? But you did it. And as soon as I came out of meditation, one thing I really noticed was my posture. Because I'd always thought that you had to be in full lotus to get into deep meditation. That's what some teachers had told me. And I looked at my posture, it wasn't full lotus. It wasn't sort of, you know, the lion pose, which you see the Buddha lying him on the side. It was all over the place, posture. Leg one way and arm the other way. All over the place. You didn't really care. And even though you were sick, the mind could actually be happy. What did you do there? There's no way I could control at that stage because I felt too tired to control. I didn't have any energy at all. You know when you're really, really sick, you just can't do anything. But you can let go. That doesn't take any willpower at all. That just takes wisdom power. And that's always there for you at any moment. No matter how tired, weak, sick you feel, you always have wisdom power. So I use the wisdom power technique. Just let go. It was lovely. Just I don't know, an hour or so, just in a nice space where you didn't feel your painful bottom or you didn't feel the sickness. And, you know, that was actually a huge relief, just having an hour away from your sickness. But it also taught me just what the power of letting go can be. When you really learn it properly, just how you can actually get free from many of those sicknesses. I know afterwards that many times, I remember Ajahn Chah telling us when he had malaria for many, many years, and you know, nothing worked. And he said the one thing which did work, and one day he was in such a huge fever, he didn't say whether he was sitting or walking or what was happening. And he said instead of trying to run away from it, he said he went to the centre of the fever. It's what often when we have pain, we want to get rid of it, we want to go somewhere where that fever isn't. But he went in the opposite direction, against the stream of pain, disappointment, trouble. He went into it. It takes a lot of guts to do that. Go right to the centre of things. Pain, fever, the door of my heart's open. Come in. You're allowing it in, you're going into it, accepting, being with, not trying to get rid of. And he said he went to the centre of this fever, and he said it was like being in a fire. This burning fire which got hotter and hotter and hotter, but he was right in the centre of it, where he couldn't feel any heat. And he said it got so hot that it just exploded. And that was the last time he had malaria fever. Fascinating experience. And you know, sometimes, I can't remember that exactly with my fever, but would be surprised if it was the same reason. They're cured by samadhi power. Things do that. You just relax and let go, get out of the way. The body starts to heal itself. So what you're actually doing here, you're also knowing how to become more healthy. And it is the case in the United States of America, in California, the monks have never told me, if you've been on a meditation retreat like this, and I give you some sort of statutory declaration that yes, you have been on a meditation retreat like this, you know how to meditate, then you can get a reduction in your health premiums. You don't get charged so much for your medical insurance. So those of you on private cover, you should write to your medical provider and say, I don't do meditation. So you should get a reduction because it does make you healthier, it does lessen the incidence of diseases, and it's healthy, tough lifestyle. So you should get a reduction in your premiums. So not only are you making yourself happy, you're saving a lot of money as well by coming here. But what we're saying though is that there's a benefit of meditation. So in order to keep those benefits going, it's actually good to take what you've learned here, put it into practice in your daily life. It will happen quite naturally, just to keep it topped up. We encourage people to, again, meditate in your daily life. By that means, not so much just being mindful, but letting go. Putting things down for moments of your day. One person I heard of, I really thought this was a very skillful means, every hour on the hour at his desk at work, he stops, closes his eyes for 1 minute, 60 seconds, and he lets go, he meditates. Every hour on the hour, doesn't matter what's happening, puts the telephone down, turns off his mobile, and just closes his eyes for 60 seconds, that's all. And he lets go and meditates. People apparently they think he's thinking about something, or just contemplating he's doing his work. So that's only 1 minute, they don't notice it. But he notices it. Because that 1 minute is enough just to calm himself down, centre himself, relax, and then he can go and work again. The other 59 minutes are much more efficient. If you try and take 10 minutes, then people will find you, or they'll think that you're sort of goofing off somewhere. But just 1 minute every hour, you find it's easy to do, and no one knows he's doing it. Very skillful means. If you can't do that, find 10 or 15 minutes just in your lunch hour. Usually allowed to have lunch. Or like you've heard me say before, that lawyer in the United States who asked his secretary to clean out the cupboard. With his secretary, he had his cupboard in his office. Every office has a cupboard somewhere. if you haven't got a cupboard, just buy a cupboard and put on it sort of top secret or sort of no unauthorized entry. And he cleaned out the cupboard, made it all free, and he put a cushion in there, and that's his meditation cupboard. And he sits in there half an hour every lunchtime, and his secretary locks him in there. So you can buy a little cupboard and get whoever's working you're working with, a friend or something, lock you in there for half an hour. And when the telephone rings, the secretary says with glee, "I'm sorry, he's in his cupboard." And he's very happy to be in the cupboard because it makes him peaceful, gives him a bit of a break from the telephone, from the email, from people coming and going. It gives him a time to meditate. And he makes up that half an hour in the afternoon very quickly. It's an investment. He's sharper, more clear, doesn't make so many mistakes, he gets his work done quicker. And she's very happy to lock him in there, because if she doesn't lock him in there, he's just a grumpy boss, so demanding, insensitive, like most people who in that situation, just because they're tired. So it's a win-win situation for everyone, even the clients. They get a better lawyer that way. So, this is actually what one can do. In home, which is the place one usually meditates, it does help to have a place where you can meditate. To find a meditation room, it is not a room, find a cupboard. If you haven't got a cupboard, buy one. And put meditation on it. You don't need a big one. It's only, look, how big is this meditation seat? Just enough to fit on there. And put some sort of lock in there, padlock or something, and padlock yourself in, or padlock somebody, you know, get someone else to padlock you in there so that you can't be disturbed. If you can't do that, just a corner of your bedroom. Just put a mat there, have it your holy corner. All you people from Singapore, you see how big the houses are in Perth? And how many rooms people have got, and they say they can't find space to meditate. You should actually go to some of the apartments, you know, in Singapore, which is so small and costs over $1 million, because they're so cramped for space, they can find place to meditate. So, all you people here in Perth, have got so much space, even in the smallest of houses, you can find a place to meditate. Your TV room, games room, rumpus room, this room, and that room. Make one sort of a meditation room. Well, it is a meditation corner. And the point is that if you make that place in your house, and you put some effort into making it, some care into making it, get a nice comfy cushion, or a meditation stool, or a chair, and then give it some ambience by a Buddha statue, or some photographs, or candles and incense, all that sort of stuff, things which are going to make it sort of holy for you. Those symbols of peace. Sometimes people just put a poster, like some seascape or something, something which makes you feel peaceful. When you get ambience like that, when you go and sit there, it feels it's the right place to go to meditate. And if you keep on doing that day after day, week after week, year after year, it builds up power. The power of the space. And then it gets so easy to meditate there. Your meditation gets better. Psychologically, the mind knows that's the place I meditate. You've done it many, many times, you've had some good experiences there, and it does build up that energy, that power. That many of you know there are powerful places to meditate in this world. And many of you have maybe even been in our sort of in our monks' monastery temple there in the main hall. That is very powerful these days, because all the meditation which has been done in there over the years has got some really oomph. And I remember even in the early years, there was a grano worker who was making our water tanks. And this grano worker's big, coarse Australian guy, a heart of gold, but just a really rough diamond. And always speaking, had the radio on, sort of already dirty. And after he finished the water tank, our main hall was there at that time, he said, "Do you mind if I have a look in your church?" he called it. And I said, "Yeah, it's not a church, it's a main hall. Once if you can come and have a look." "Oh, thanks." And so I went with him, and he was with his boots, his dirty, stained overalls, and his even like a concrete stained face as well, it was all splashed with concrete all over it. And he was talking to so much on the way into that hall. He wouldn't stop talking at all. But as soon as we got to the entrance, he said, "Should I take off my boots?" And he had so many laces on, out of compassion, I said, "No, look, keep your boots tight, just poke your head around the corner and have a look." Which he did. And as soon as his head just went past those inner doors into the hall, it was amazing. He just went completely quiet. He went silent. And I just let him be silent for a while. I never said anything. And then after about 2 minutes, he turned around and said, "God, this is good, isn't it, Brian?" And I always remember those words. It really touched me. "God, this is good, isn't it, Brian?" He'd actually felt the silence. And it cooled him completely off. He'd gone from just heavy work, talking about all sorts of things, his mind was so restless, he just put his head in that hall there, and he'd fallen into some sort of meditation. The first time he'd been still for I don't know how long. And his words were, "This is good, isn't it?" He'd actually felt the peace. And so sometimes that happens in some places. It's got so much power, even the most restless minds, it soaks up their energy and they get silent. And that's why there's some places are very nice to meditate. They're very easy to meditate. So after a while, actually I always take my meditation cushion with me. And when I'm sitting in my monastery, this has gone, ooh. Ooh, when I was in Singapore, when I was at the retreat, I did bring my cushion because I had too much to carry on the plane. So they gave me a cushion, and after the retreat they auctioned it. good way of making plans. But anyway, so there are places which have got lots of power. If you set up your little corner of your room, or your cupboard, or wherever it is, a place in your house, you keep on meditating, and after a while it actually does feel like you're getting some power in there. It's easy to meditate. And what a marvellous resource that is for your house. A place when you feel tired when you come back from work. You don't need to have energy. Like I had fever, you can just sit there and just relax, let go. You're not trying to focus on the breath. You're not trying to get into jhana. You're making peace with the moment. A fundamental course of action for meditation. Letting go of the doer. Just allowing things to be. Allowing things to unwind. Being absolutely at peace. So you just sit down there and rest and relax. If you had an argument with the person you live with, instead of actually going to some sort of women's refuge or men's refuge or going into the men's refuge is, that's called the pub. Instead of actually doing silly things like that, go to your little space, sit down in there, and you'll find it just heals so many problems. Like I was saying, before having the rest, I could be critical about anybody, but when I was rested, relaxed, all those little things I was arguing with my fellow monks about seem so petty, and you've got things in perspective when you're quiet. So you just go and sit down in there, things become in perspective, and those little arguments in the family just dissipate and they're gone. Become more caring, more loving, because loving is the door of my heart's open to you, no matter who you are, no matter what you do. Little things don't make so much problem anymore. When you're tired, they're huge. When you're rested, they're nothing. So you can actually solve so many marital problems. When I've given this advice so many times over the years, it works. One family in Perth came and told me this story. They made a little meditation place in their house. And it happened one day, they had two children, a boy and a girl. They had a fight in front of the house, in the garden somewhere. as kids do from time to time. And they could only be about 6 or 7 or 5 or something. And the little girl was in tears. And instead of running to mummy for consolation, she ran into mummy's bedroom. She ran into the meditation corner and sat down to quiet herself down. The kid knew intuitively that was the place to go when you're upset, when you're in turmoil. That's the place to go to calm down. And the mother never told her. The kid just did it. That's all. Sometimes even the cats and dogs do that when you meditate. They come down to enjoy your peace. And they feel it. And they don't bother you. If you're sitting quietly down there, that cat or dog will sit next to you as quiet as anything until you finish your meditation. And then they'll get up with you. They don't seek, you know, don't jump on your lap and want to be stroked or bark at you because it's their dinner time. They sit down there and wait because they get into your vibes and peace. So you set up this nice peaceful corner here. And it's a resource for the whole family. It's better than going to a psychologist. You've got your own little place there where you can really sort of be peace. So that's the advice we should give you when you go back out after this retreat. You've learned very much already, no matter what you think you've done. Oh, great retreat, not so good retreat, I'm hopeless, I'm tremendous. That's not the point. You've all learned a lot. Much of what you've learned, you don't realise you've learned it. You've been brainwashed. You notice it first time when you go out of these gates, you start to ask just how much you've changed. And you have resources to live your life with more peace, getting into less problems. Whether you're sick, you're happy at peace. When there's nothing to do, you know how to let go. When there's people in your family going crazy, you can just let them go like that water buffalo. And you can bring them back afterwards, but not when they're unstoppable. You know how to deal with the Nalagiri mind, the mad elephant mind, or the mad elephant world, with kindness. You're gaining lots of skills. Those skills lead to happiness in this life. They lead to nibbana eventually. When you're ready for enlightenment, that will happen. Don't need to rush. But on the way, it makes life much more easy, much more happy. So you've come here not just to get enlightened, but just to have a happier and peaceful life. It's not just for yourself. It's for all those people that have to put up with you. So, any questions about dealing with life through meditation? Yeah.
Did you mention about all the power and stuff like that? Is it possible that some place is too powerful for someone to feel?
Yeah, that's, you wouldn't think it, but yeah, it's true. You know, some years ago I did a 6-month retreat in my monastery, and one hut never sort of went more than, it was only just about 20 metres from the hut to pick up my food and back again. Lived in there for 6 months, doing my meditation. Not speaking to anybody, that's 6 months. I was really having a great time. But afterwards, when I came out, so actually I found out the monks were just jostling for who'd be the next one to stay in that hut. And you know, they all wanted to stay in there to get the power. And the monk who actually, you know, managed to go into that hut after me, I think he said the first day he couldn't stay in it. Just too much power for him. He just, you know, too much energy. No, too much peace about. So he actually to go out, and I think only after a day or two he got used to the place. So yeah, sometimes you can get huge powers going in those places.
Actually, that was what I was
referring
to. I remember you saying that.
That's
somebody,
yeah.
Yeah, but why is it so?
Why is it so? Because it's almost like the atmosphere around there gets charged with the person who's been in there. And it's like it's so peaceful, so quiet. And if your mind is not at that level, there's like a disharmony there. And there's a sense that the place is actually pulling you down to peacefulness, but you don't want to go. So that's one of the difficulties. You know that, you know, what attachments, you know, one of my favourite stories about attachment, I should actually say this because it's the last day of the retreat. And it's the one about the worm spoiling the pile of dung. I love this story to tell at the end of the retreat. So even if you heard it before, I'm going to say this. There were 2 monks. They were practicing well. At least they thought they were. And when they both died, that one of them got reborn in the heaven realm. As one of these heavenly beings, having a wonderful time. Because of his good karma. The other one got reborn as a worm in a pile of stinking dung. Because of some bad karma. And after a while, the one in the heaven realm started to think, oh, where's my friend been reborn? We were so close together in our previous lives. Because he couldn't find him in that heaven realm. Maybe he's been reborn in the higher heaven realm. So he looked in that higher heaven realm, couldn't find him there. Let's go to the lower realms, see if he's been in the lower heaven realm. Couldn't find him anywhere. And thought, my goodness, I know. He's got the fortunate rebirth straight away of being a human being. So he used his psychic powers and checked out all the human realm and couldn't find his friend there at all. Said, oh my goodness, surely he hasn't been reborn as an animal. And he checked out all the animals, couldn't find him there at all. And just to make sure, he checked out the realm of the creepy crawlies. And to his horror and dismay, he found out that his mate, his best friend from a previous life, had got this terrible rebirth as a worm in a pile of dung. And that as monks, you know, we have a great sense of friendship and mateship. You know, we'll help each other out. That's part of being a monk. You know, these are your friends. So this heavenly being said, I can't leave my friend like that, being reborn in a pile of dung. I'm going to go and help him. So he manifested in front of that pile of dung, and he called out, hey worm, worm. And the little head of the worm poked out from the pile of dung. Yeah, what do you want? He said, now listen. So in our past lives, you know, we used to be monks together. And we were the best of friends. Now, but sometimes karma is this way and sometimes karma is that way. It's, you know, it's nothing personal, but I've been reborn up in the heaven realm. It's so wonderful up there. Now you've been reborn as part of that. It's really bad luck. But because of friendship, I can actually take you up to heaven. Come along. And the worm said, hang on a moment. What is this heaven business? And the heavenly beings started to describe the pleasures and the beauty of heaven, just wonderful food, wonderful music. And the worm interrupted, hey, look, let's get to the point here. Is there any dung up in heaven? And heaven being, of course there's no dung up in heaven. The worm said, no dung, I'm not going. And he went back into his pile of dung. And the heavenly beings thought, oh my goodness, how many, you know, teach this little worm that it's actually nice up in heaven, that heaven is much better than dung. He's attached to his dung. So, the heavenly being, this is how much friendship goes. Now the friendship will just go to extreme lengths. So the heavenly being said, look, if I can actually take this worm to see heaven for himself, you can actually see it, experience it for yourself, then maybe he'd understand. And so the heavenly being, you know, just heavenly beings are very refined. And for a heavenly being to do this was really a sacrifice. He held his nose, put his hand in the middle of the pile of dung, and searched around for the worm to try and catch it. And he did catch hold of the worm and started pulling it out of compassion to take it to heaven. He almost got it out, but that worm was going frantic. Leave me alone! Go away! I don't want to go! And he was struggling and wriggling like worms do, and because he was all sticky and slimy, so eventually he wriggled enough, he managed to escape. And as soon as he escaped, he went right down to the deepest part of the dung again, to hide. But then, you know, friendship is very strong. So the heavenly being put his hand in there again, searched around, found him again, started pulling him out, hey, leave me alone! And he screamed and yelled and wriggled and escaped again. And the heavenly being went, found him again, pulled him out again, he escaped again. Many times, the heavenly being almost got him out of this pile of dung. But because he really didn't want to go, the little worm escaped and went back again. In the end, the heavenly being had to go back up to heaven alone and leave the worm to his pile of dung. At the end of the retreat, that simile, I'm like the heavenly being.
You don't want to go! I've almost got you out a few times. Some of you see the limiter. Oh, no, 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 no.
You wriggle back in there. Why? Because that's where you're attached to. Okay, any other questions? Okay, let's leave it there for now. I know that one of the retreatants here wants to do an article about the retreat, so she may take some photographs later on today. If you take a photograph while you're meditating, where your eyes close, if you see a flash, it's not the limiter. Okay. So please understand that. And there's a few interviews left, and after the interviews are finished, a nice lunch. From lunchtime onwards, once you get in there at 11 o'clock, you're allowed to speak again, if you want to. So if you want to speak, you can speak. But if you don't want to speak, sit in the table or go outside where you know, you don't need to speak. Or if you know, don't want to speak, you can put your hand up as a sign that, you know, not that the other person needs to stop speaking, but you'd rather not speak. So please respect other people's wishes if they don't want to take advantage of the end of the speaking rule. Because you know, lunchtime afterwards, you can go off and be quiet by yourself, but if you want to speak, you can speak now. Just easing you back. And also, I think at 2:30, can everyone come back in here? Because we'll do the last little session at 2:30, which is a little bit of a talk again, just a few minutes, seconds, and a bit of a meta-meditation. And after meta-meditation, just we give a blessing for all the food which has been offered to the monks, for all the care you've given to us, and just to celebrate the fact that you've done something wonderful for the last 9 days, meditating. So that's going to happen from 2:30, and we usually finish off by 3:30. And at 3:30 is the time to do a little chores to get ourselves ready for going home, nice and peacefully, nice and quietly. So that's from 2:30 to 3:30. Is that okay? Any questions about that? Okay, so let's have the interviews now. And those two of you who want to give one last shot at enlightenment, there's another couple of hours yet for lunch. And after lunch, there's still many hours left. Who knows? Your water jar might just be full. Maybe that little neighbour might get a solid grip on you after all. And take you out of the first time. Okay, thanks a lot.